Boas tardes a todos e todas. Moitas gracias por acudir unha vez máis a este ciclo, esta serie de debate sobre os sentidos da cultura. Hoxe temos, como ben vedes, unha convidada especial, e ademais que enviou un texto que creo que está moi axeitado para o que é esta orientación do ciclo Sentidos da Cultura, que é Ann Phillips. Agradezo-vos a todos a vosa presencia e a moitos dos que estades con frecuencia nestos ciclos, tamén a vosa pertinacia en asistir, e os que vides por primeira vez ou de forma alternativa, pois esperamos que con certa frecuencia vos vexamos aquí, de modo que moi boas tardes a todos. E o profesor Ramón Maiz fará a presentación da convidada.
Bueno, boas tardes, gracias pola vosa presencia. Compráceme especialmente darlle a palabra hoxe no seminario Sentidos da Cultura a Ann Phillips, porque de as súas primeiras obras, A Política da Presencia, até a súa última, saída do prelo ano pasado, Multiculturalismo sen Cultura, ven abordando temas sustanciais para o noso seminario, centrado precisamente, como ben sabedes, en derredor do alcance e significado da cultura. Cecais, poucas personas como ela teñen exemplificado no seu desenvolvemento intelectual e nas súas argumentacións que o feminismo significa, desde o punto de vista da filosofía política, non somente unha posición particular, senón que desafía o conxunto de conceptos que se empregan noutras dimensións, e dai que teña esa capacidade de desinstalación en derredor do que consideramos, por exemplo, identidades colectivas, comunidades, etc., etc. Por canto, sempre amosou unha retesía importante ao efecto das concepcións holísticas de comunidade, de tal xeito que dar a voz á comunidade moitas veces implicaba darlle xustamente a unha versión patriarcal desas comunidades. Esa perspectiva antiholística e antiesencialista é justamente o que nos interesa das posicións de Ann Phillips, que ven mantendo nos seus diversos escritos. Por lo tanto, sen máis pola miña parte, que darlle a palabra.
Thank you very much indeed for the effort you made coming today with us to discuss your issues or your views about the and moreover with this title or multiculturalism without culture. Thank you very much indeed, when you like.
Well, thank you very much, and I'm very honoured to be part of this series of seminars. I'll sort of follow my text reasonably closely, and if I go too fast, just wave or something, I'll slow down. So I want to start with reasons why multiculturalism might be important. So just sort of start with what seem to me the three main claims that lie behind multiculturalism. The first is a claim that culture matters to people, so that trivializing or disparaging a cultural identity can be a genuine harm. The second claim that lies behind the multiculturalism is that contemporary societies are characterized by a multiplicity of cultures, you know, that we live in multi rather than monocultural societies. And the third claim, the sort of the more directly political claim, is the idea that the laws, rules, institutions of any given society are likely to be biased towards the identities and interests of majority or dominant or hegemonic cultural groups, with sort of obvious implications for unequal treatment of different citizens of the society. Now, if you put those together, it seems to me that there are some very clear policy implications. Equality between citizens requires us to re-examine laws, regulations, institutions, conventions for unintended or deliberate bias. And when we discover this unintended or deliberate bias, to modify the regulations and institutions so as better to reflect cultural diversity. Sort of a minor example of this, and this is an example from the United Kingdom, is that in the 1970s and 80s there were regulations, environmental regulations, that regulated what could or couldn't be disposed of in running water. And then it turned out that this seriously disadvantaged Hindu families who had a tradition of casting funeral ashes into running water. So that was a minor example of a regulation that had been framed with a kind of a sort of majority dominant culture in mind and turned out to have a bias and a disadvantage to minority group. And in that case, there was the regulations were modified to recognise that. Obviously, a much more major and more controversial example would be the request for separate systems of personal and family law so as to regulate the affairs of religious minorities within Europe, which is a request or claim or demand that has been made by a very small minority of spokespeople for Muslim groups within contemporary Europe. But is generally repudiated by the majority of Muslims, and it's unlikely that that request would be met in contemporary Europe. Multiculturalism can mean a range of major to minor adjustments, but it seems to me that some version of multiculturalism is required in societies in contemporary Europe for reasons of fairness and equity. And I myself remain a firm supporter of multiculturalism. The problem, however, is that some versions of multiculturalism have relied on what I see as a very reified and essentialized understanding of culture, and those are the ones that I want to criticize in this paper. And just to put that in its political context, I think part of the political context for my own thoughts about this is the what seems to me the very major retreat that's going on in contemporary Europe from even the rather modest multicultural ideas that were adopted in a number of European countries, so that in my own country, in Britain, there's been much recent talk of the death of multiculturalism, the bigotries of multiculturalism, the way multiculturalism encourages us to live in parallel societies, the way in which it's seen as it's associated with all kinds of failures of social and economic or political integration. And there's been a shift in many countries in Europe, I think, to a sort of focus on a much more a kind of a common core of citizenship values that are perceived as the necessary cement that holds a multicultural society together. Now, at a more theoretical level, people have argued that multiculturalism is dangerous either because it gives too much power to cultural groups over their members, or because it exaggerates the internal unity of cultures, that solidifies differences that are currently more fluid, and makes people from other cultures seem more different and more exotic than they really are. Now, that first criticism, the idea that some versions of multiculturalism encourages us to give too much power to cultural groups over those that the groups claim as their members, that's been, I think, particularly associated with feminist arguments. There's been a strong tradition of feminist argument, which has argued that some versions and practices of multiculturalism end up strengthening the power of men over women, the power of older people over younger, and reinforcing the most conservative understandings of a culture and its practices. So that's one kind of line of criticism. The second line of criticism is more general, and that's when multiculturalism is said wrongly to assume that people are defined by a single unified culture, when in fact all of us, I think, create our identities through multiple borrowings from many different cultural sources. And those who argue from this perspective, and I have a lot of sympathy with this argument, see multiculturalism as a kind of cultural straitjacket, something that kind of forces particularly those who are described as members of a minority cultural group into a kind of like a false authenticity, kind of, you know, requiring them to kind of like become more and more pure members of what is said to be their culture's characteristics. Now, those two worries, the worry that some versions of multiculturalism might encourage a sort of, in a sense, a very conservative understanding of culture, which becomes comes to be used almost as a kind of weapon against dissident members of a cultural group, and the worry that anyway, all of us are kind of products of multiple overlapping cultural sources. I mean, both of those are concerns that that motivate my own approach. So, at its simplest, I continue to be, for the reasons I set out at the beginning, a supporter of multiculturalism. I think we need multiculturalism in contemporary societies, but I think it's got to be a multiculturalism that rests on a very sceptical understanding of this notion of culture. So just to go on to some thoughts about culture. I think the critique of this notion of culture is most fully developed in the anthropological and the sociological literature. I myself am primarily a political theorist. But in the anthropological and sociological literature, it's often linked with a critique of notions like ethnicity, notions like community, and notions like race. The idea that race is a kind of false notion, that there are no such things as races in the world, is, I think, now pretty much the common sense within contemporary sociologists. Most sociologists nowadays, many sociologists nowadays will only use the term with quotation marks around it. As Kwame Anthony Appiah has noted, small intermarrying communities like the Amish in North America might be better candidates for the term race than a group like African Americans, who are estimated to derive up to 30% of their genetic material from European or American Indian ancestors. So if by race we mean something that's kind of like somehow genetically based, it's usually used in a kind of completely inappropriate and misleading context. Human beings clearly vary in their skin colour and their physiognomy, but the kind of it was only really in the process of justifying slavery and colonialism that those characteristics became wrapped up in packages along with supposed qualities like strength, intelligence, creativity, the capacity for hard work, and out of that we had the creation of these categories of race. That's become a very common argument in the sociological literature, and it's one that I would endorse. The term ethnicity is often thought of as kind of like slightly more reliable than the term race, and it's become the, I think, preferred term in recent years. But ethnicity is also very widely attacked, and I mean, it was criticized, in fact, by Max Weber as early as 1912 for its lack of conceptual rigor. And I think one of the problems that people sort of raise when they talk about how we misuse the term ethnicity is that it commits what Rogers Brubaker has described as the error of groupism, by which he means, quote, the tendency to take discrete, sharply differentiated, internally homogeneous, and externally bounded groups as basic constituents of social life, to see them as chief protagonists of social conflict and fundamental units of social analysis. And Rogers Brubaker just thinks that that is just a kind of a very misleading representation of the, you know, what actually happens in social interactions. Brubach is not denying that people may identify themselves in terms of their ethnicity. You know, if you know, if we ask, you know, people, you know, what are you? Who are you? People will very often come up with some description in terms of ethnicity, and clearly, very often, people are identified. We identify those we see as our enemies very often in terms of ethnicity. I mean, he's not denying that. But he argues that when you get what are described as ethnic conflicts, that the kind of, you know, the protagonists, the kind of the figures that work in this, aren't groups, ethnic groups, but organizations, and usually organizations that have a vested interest, a political interest, in making people see themselves in ethnic terms. So what he's arguing there is that it makes most sense to think of groupness as something that is made to happen. You know, it's not that we exist in groups, you know, by virtue of some original, you know, ethnic distinction, but that these distinctions come into being through a political process in which they're made to happen. Now, I think those reservations, I mean, I've gone through race, ethnicity, and I'm using that as a kind of, you know, a background to lead into similar reservations about the notion of culture. And I think a lot of people have argued that cultures, the boundaries between cultures are themselves political creations. Riva Castoriano, talking in the French context, talks of, quote, the invention of a culture that claims to be collective and sees this actually as part of the process in which ethnic groups define themselves in ways that allow them to lay claim to public resources. So it's kind of, in a sense, part of a political mobilization in order to achieve resources. I mean, I've noted that feminists have been very troubled by some of the language of culture and cultural groups, and particularly worried about a tendency towards cultural essentialism, which is seen as a sort of a discourse of culture that allows the more powerful, usually male, usually older members of a group, to codify what are typically, you know, changing and contested and fragmented practices. The language of culture allows the older members of a group to codify those, in a sense freeze them, establish a kind of authoritative reading, this is what the culture requires you to do, in ways that then close down options for members of that group. Now, in the field of political theory, which is my own background, people have tended to be much more trusting in the way in which they've used the notion of culture and cultural group. There's a kind of much less critical investigation of what exactly is going on when we use the term culture or when we talk about cultural group. So that there's a tendency to take the existence of particularly ethno-cultural groups as just a starting point, and then political theorists say, well, we have these ethno-cultural groups, they're making various political claims, what's the appropriate way to deal with it? Now, so that in a sense, ethnic diversity is taken as a kind of fact, cultural difference is taken as a kind of fact, and then all of the interesting questions come at that point onwards. And I don't think that, you know, in itself is either surprising or particularly blameworthy, because, you know, political theorists deal in questions of justice, equality, autonomy, and in a period that's been dominated by a discourse of human rights, have been particularly preoccupied by what rights, if any, can be claimed by minority groups. So it's not surprising that the focus is all on that, but it does seem to me it's problematic that very few of those political theorists step a stage backwards and say, well, you know, what is the basis for making these claims about the existence of these supposedly distinct, separate, sort of independently defined cultural groups? I think in the political theorist's understanding of culture, cultural group comes to be associated with a kind of quasi-legal entity. that has historically enjoyed or is now claiming some kind of jurisdiction over its members. And this solidifies the cultural group into something very substantial. The group is presumed, moreover, to play a very large role in the loyalties of its members, hence the emphasis from theorists like Charles Taylor onwards on the responsibility states have to extend due respect and recognition to cultures. And let me just give you one quote, which is from this is from Jacob Levy in his book The Multiculturalism of Fear, where he's talking about what you know, he's talking about ethnocultural identities, and he links our sense of cultural belonging very firmly to a demarcation between those we see as ours and those we see as strangers. So this quote from Jacob Levy: persons identify and empathize more easily with those with whom they have more in common than with those with whom they have less. They rally around their fellow religionists. They seek the familiar comforts of native speakers of their native languages. They support those they see as kin against those they see as strangers. They seek places that feel like home, and they seek to protect those places. They are raised in particular cultures with particular sets of knowledge, norms, and traditions, which come to seem normal and enduring. And these feelings, repeated and generalized, help give rise to a world of ethnic, cultural, and national loyalty, and a world of enduring ethnic, cultural, and national variety. Now, it's not that what he says is complete nonsense, I don't mean that, but what comes out of that, it seems to me, is a very bounded idea of cultures, you know, that we're all, in a sense, you know, we're all kind of defined by, you know, caught within our particular kinship group, really, the people that we are, that we feel familiar with. And it's also a very oppositional idea of culture. I mean, in that understanding, my culture means not yours. You know, it's almost kind of built into our understanding of culture that it has that kind of implication. And, I mean, just to kind of, I suppose, it seems to me in terms of understanding why the political theorists who've talked about multiculturalism have been, I think, so relatively uncritical of the ways in which they use the notions of culture, or kind of not really inquired much further about what makes a cultural group. I think part of the reason for that is that a lot of the political theory of multiculturalism developed in the Canadian context. I mean, some of the key figures in it initially were people like Charles Taylor, Will Kimlicker, and developed very much in a context that was dealing with issues such as the claims for autonomy or independence of Quebec within Canada, very much looking at questions of national minorities, and of course in the case of Quebec, very much a national minority which is defined in relation to a language. And a lot of Charles Taylor very often said in his writings about Quebec, actually, if you look at Quebec, culturally, it's no different from the rest of Canada. The key thing about Quebec is that it has its own distinctive language. Now, there's a sense in which language does provide you with a kind of much more bounded sense. I mean, you know, you speak a language or you don't speak a language. And I think there may be something about the way in which the political theory of multiculturalism got formed so much by its thoughts about linguistic minorities that perhaps contributed to a relatively uncritical sense of how bounded culture was or isn't. But anyway, we can come back to that in discussion. Okay, in what I sort of the paper that I've given you today, I basically focus on what I think are two worrying consequences of this overly solid, holistic, reified depiction of the cultural group. The first is that this thing called culture comes to be seen as the major source of people's identity and major determinant of their actions and behaviour, in ways that I think mean that somehow a whole complex of other sort of individual variations and differences disappear from view. That's the first problem. The second problem is that culture in the language of multiculturalism, culture comes to be seen as something primarily associated with non-Western or minority cultural groups. You know, you use the term culture in the language of multiculturalism always to refer to the minority groups. It's those who have this thing called culture rather than the rest. And I think that it's kind of, in a way, that's it's almost built into some of the ways in which the argument for multiculturalism proceeds, because you know, the political case for multiculturalism, as it comes to rest in part or precisely on the importance that people attach to their cultural identities, you know, that's why, you know, if people didn't attach importance to their cultural identities, we wouldn't need multiculturalism. So it's because people attach importance to their cultural identities that we need multiculturalism. But then, as it comes to rest more and more on that, there's a sense in which the hold that culture exerts over people, I think, is highlighted and exaggerated. And culture in the process becomes exoticized, by which I mean it comes to be attached to the other, to the minority, and in the European context, to the non-Western group. Culture comes to be represented as something of enormous importance to the individual. It's treated as more important to our sense of ourselves than our sex, for example, or our social class, and it's attributed far more explanatory value. But then the greater the importance that's attached to cultural belonging, it seems to me the more likely it is that culture will be seen as something that matters to others, not to me. Because actually in most people's lives, culture is a kind of pretty ordinary, taken-for-granted background. I mean, such a sort of taken-for-granted background that we only become aware of the norms and assumptions that give meaning to our actions, of what it is that we do that is culturally distinctive. I mean, we become aware of that, most of us, at the moment when we're confronted with cultures very different from our own. Culture, in that sense, tends to be less visible to those who are in a hegemonic culture. I mean, if you're in the hegemonic culture, you're less aware of the sense in which you have a culture, you know, because you're not constantly confronted by the sense in which what you do is different from what is being done around you. And actually, I mean, people in the hegemonic culture, I could cite myself as an example of this in my own sort of, you know, social, political context. People in the hegemonic culture will readily acknowledge the influence of class or gender on their attitudes and behaviour, right, and say, yes, you know, I can see that the way I am has been significantly formed by, you know, my class background or, you know, or my sex or, you know, that people will acknowledge that. But very rarely, if you're in the hegemonic culture, you very rarely cite your culture as part of the explanation of why you do. So that's the kind of related to the second aspect about the way culture comes to be, in a sense, increasingly identified with minorities, minority experiences. There's a nice section from a book by the American political theorist Uma Narayan in her book Dislocating Cultures, where she's interested in the way in which there's been this whole outpouring of writings about the problem of dowry murder in India, and the way in which this is attributed to this thing called Hindu culture, that Hindu culture is the explanation for the women who are being killed because of the failure of their families to deliver the dowry to their husbands. And she imagines, she conjures up an imaginary Indian journalist who has travelled to America to write an analysis of the ways in which something called American culture is killing women. You know, and this would be an analysis of domestic violence within the American context. So it would be a sort of parallel to the way in which, you know, American journalists have gone to India and talked about the way that Indian culture is killing Indian women. And basically she concludes that this can only remain an imaginary chapter in an improbable book. I mean, it's just not possible in the ways in which we currently talk about culture, to think of American culture in the way in which people so very easily seem to be able to talk about Indian culture as this somehow, this explanatory cause of a whole set of phenomena. Let me see how I'm going for time. I mean, one of the illustrations that I give in the paper that that you have available is an issue that's been very much discussed in the literature on feminism and multiculturalism, which is the issue of cultural defence, the use of culture as a defence in legal cases, criminal cases involving violence against women. And I mean, I think the literature on this was sparked particularly by a number of high-profile legal cases, cases that came to court in the United States, which raised fears that defendants would be able successfully to invoke what they described as the values and traditions of their culture in order to mitigate acts of violence against women. And one of the much-discussed cases from the 1980s was that of a Chinese immigrant to New York who killed his wife, I mean, battered her to death, basically, after discovering that she was having an affair. And in the defense, a sort of expert was called to testify about you know, traditional Chinese values about adultery and the loss of manhood. And in fact, in the light of, you know, the judge amazingly accepted a lot of these arguments. I mean, the idea that you could talk about Chinese culture when you think about the size and scale of China. But anyway, he, you know, in the light of what he accepted were traditional Chinese values about adultery and the loss of manhood, he sentenced Dong Luchen to only 5 years probation. In the light of cases like that, there's been a lot of kind of anxiety about the ways in which culture has actually been invoked in some of these cases. In fact, my own kind of, I think the most recent and comprehensive study of cultural defence comes to the conclusion that these are rather minority examples, that in the most cases judges are very resistant to listening to any stories about culture, and that actually fits more with my own search of some of the cases in the English, Welsh and Scottish courts. But I do think that the idea that lies behind that, the notion that somehow people are driven by their culture to behave in particular kinds of ways, even if it's not being recognized, even if it's not being accepted as an argument in the law courts, it is something that has become very much part of a kind of popular understanding of culture in a way that I think is very seriously problematic. I think we should be highly suspicious of those kinds of understandings of culture and cultural difference, where culture is presented as this thing which has a kind of form of power over people, you know, such that what people do can be explained by reference to something that is said to be their culture. I think we should be highly suspicious whenever, for example, we hear people saying they behave like that because they're Turkish, or because they're Asian, or because they're Muslim, as if those very large generalities tell us anything particularly helpful about why people act the way they do. I think it's become commonplace in talking of problems like forced marriage or honour killing, you know, both of which have emerged as you know, significant areas of political debate and policy intervention in Europe in recent years. It's become commonplace in talking of those problems for politicians to say culture is no excuse, right? And obviously what they mean by that is that saying that something is part of one's culture or tradition or heritage is no excuse for killing somebody, right? Which I completely agree with. Well, culture is indeed no excuse. But what I'm trying to kind of argue in this paper is that it's not just that culture is no excuse. In most cases, culture is also not much of an explanation. You know, that we can't kind of like appeal to this thing called culture as the explanation when, for example, men are violent towards their wives or daughters. We usually need to look to a wider set of explanations, ones more based in the specifics of individual history. And, I mean, one of the examples I've sort of talked about these issues in a number of contexts, and I mean, one of the things that people often say to me is, well, you know, are you saying culture doesn't matter? Are you saying there is no such thing as cultural difference? Are you saying, you know, it has no significance in that way? Which is not what I'm saying, right? So I'm trying to find a way of saying that there are cultural differences, but we've got to get away from thinking of this as culture with a capital C, or culture as, you know, you're this culture or you're that culture, or culture as kind of these frozen sort of totalized notions. And I mean, one example I've found quite useful here derives from Ireland in the 1950s and 60s. And I mean, some of you may have seen the film The Magdalene Sisters, which is based on this experience. But basically, I mean, in Ireland, there were a sort of number of what were called the Magdalene laundries, which were basically prison-like buildings housing young women who had in some way sinned against the social and sexual conventions of the time. Mostly they'd become pregnant outside of marriage, or in some way they'd caused a scandal in their local community. And, you know, they'd been placed in these Magdalene institutions by their parents, usually on the advice of the parish priest. And many of them then remained virtually as prisoners in these laundries, where they, you know, they made a living by taking in washing from neighbouring homes and hotels and so on. And many of them remained virtually as prisoners in these institutions for many years. Those who were pregnant had to give up their babies for adoption, of course. Now, when you think about that, I mean, if you try to understand how those kinds of institutions could have existed in the 1950s and 60s, in fact, the last ones weren't closed down in Ireland until the 1970s, and how, you know, that kind of incarceration of young women would be regarded as just completely brutal today. I mean, you wouldn't, I think, find anyone in contemporary Ireland who would argue for the return of the Magdalene laundries, right? So if you try and kind of think about, well, you know, how do you make sense of that very different context in Ireland in the 1950s and 60s and Ireland today? We will, with reason, turn to the notion of culture, cultural change, cultural difference. There's been some kind of major cultural shift which has explained this. In Ireland in the 1950s and 60s, there was a very strongly held conviction that sex outside marriage was a sin. The church had enormous power and authority, and fathers had very considerable power and authority over their children, which I think most fathers don't have these days. Certainly mothers don't. Now, since then, there's been a major cultural shift, right? So, you know, the notion of, you know, cultural change, cultural shift, the significance of culture in explaining, you know, the ways in which people why people do what they do. You know, I'm not denying that. But both then and now, there was enormous individual variation. I mean, it was never the case that every parent in Ireland in the 1950s and 60s who discovered a kind of a daughter had become pregnant outside marriage immediately marched her off to the nearest Magdalene laundry. Some parents would be more horrified than others if their daughters got pregnant. Some would be horrified, but they would determine nonetheless to support their daughters. And some would be relatively untroubled by what their neighbours and the priest saw as immoral transgression. what individuals do and think never lend themselves very neatly to cultural explanation. We can't just say it's the culture, you know, that's why people do what they do. You know, we always have to kind of like look for much more complex and usually more individual explanations. The other example that I give in the paper is taken from outside Europe, and that's a very interesting paper about a successful village-led campaign against female genital cutting in Senegal in West Africa, which was carried out under the auspices of an educational NGO called Tostan. Now, the experience of this NGO is that, just to go back a stage, I mean, if you think about female genital cutting, this looks like an absolutely classic illustration of the power of culture, right? I mean, when women have been asked why they continue with what they know to be a dangerous and painful practice, and I say when women are asked because very often it's the mothers and the aunts and the grandmothers who are responsible for ensuring the genital mutilation of their daughters. When women are asked why they continue, they typically cite custom and tradition, right? Female genital cutting therefore seems a particularly clear illustration of the power of culture and the way it regulates people's lives. But the other way of reading this, and this was the kind of interpretation in this case, was that what sustains that practice is precisely the knowledge that everyone around you is doing it, and the knowledge that your own daughters will become unmarriageable if your family is the only family that opts out. I mean, so the kind of just the enormous pressure to conform, because otherwise you're denying your daughters the chance of marriage. And, you know, what the Tostan initiative sort of came up with this kind of like approach to genital cutting and genital cutting, in which they developed the device of the collective pledge. That is, they signed villagers up to a date when they would all simultaneously renounce the practice. They would all kind of act together and say, from this day onwards, you know, none of us will allow our daughters to be subjected to this practice. So that the kind of with the guarantee that others would also relinquish, it became much easier for people to simply just say we don't want to do this anymore. This was the 1990s. One village collectively abandoned the practice, and then representatives of the neighbouring villages followed suit, and then there was a snowball effect which spread through the region, and then a couple of years later, the government, which had been very supportive of the initiative, enacted legislation officially prohibiting the practice. And now what's striking about that story to me is how easy it proved to bring about the change. This practice of female genital cutting clearly has its origins in culture. I mean, you couldn't explain it, you know, without using the term culture. It's a cultural phenomenon. It gets its meaning and its significance from culture. But the loyalty to the practice turned out to be very thin. You know, there was no kind of deep cultural attachment which kind of went so deep into people's sense of identity. Just much more simply and practically in that example, I'm not saying that that's true of all examples, much more simply and practically, you know, the problem was how to change practices unless everyone else did the same thing at the same time. And I think what stands out for me in that example is how similar people are across what might otherwise seem quite major cultural differences. The reasons that village representatives gave for wanting to renounce the practice were very much the ones that would be given by parents around the world. They wanted to ensure their girls' health. They were worried about their bodily integrity and human dignity. But the reasons that they'd previously given for continuing with the practice, not wanting to make their girls unmanageable, you know, also, you know, it's not particularly mysterious kind of or hard to understand. Now, I'm not in saying that, again, I'm not saying that there are no cultural differences between the Senegalese villagers and, say, villagers in rural France. Or indeed, I'm not saying that there are no cultural differences between the Senegalese villagers and the Senegalese political elite. And I'm certainly not trying to suggest that we all make sense of our lives and our relationships in the same way. But it does seem to me that that's a case where there was no special need to rely on a theory of profound cultural difference in order to make sense either of the persistence or, in that context, the eventual ending of genital cutting. I think in popular, particularly, perhaps less so in theoretical or academic, but in popular uses of the term culture, there's a tendency to call on this thing called culture when we're faced with something we can't understand. Or as the anthropologist Adam Cooper has put it, when commenting on a burst of cultural theorizing in 20th century modernization theory, quotes, "Culture was invoked when it became necessary to explain why people were clinging to irrational goals and self-destructive strategies. Culture was the fallback to explain apparently irrational behavior." So basically, if you can't make sense of what's going on, you say it must be their culture, right? I mean, that's the only way you can understand it. I want really to end with a quote from another anthropologist, Laila Abu Lugolt, who once recommended what she called an ethnography of the particular that brings out similarities in people's lives. The particulars, she says, if we focus on the particulars suggest that others live as we perceive ourselves living, not as robots programmed with cultural rules, but as people going through life, agonizing over decisions, making mistakes, trying to make themselves look good, enduring tragedies and personal losses, enjoying others, and finding moments of happiness. Now, again, recognizing those similarities across the human condition, as you might describe it, recognizing those similarities doesn't, of course, mean discounting differences, right? I mean, I'm not, to repeat, I'm not saying, you know, that there is no such thing as cultural difference. I mean, I think what we count as tragedy, for example, what any one person counts as tragedy, is going to be inflected by cultural norms, right? My book is called Multiculturalism Without Culture, which is a deliberately polemical title, because I don't mean that there is no such thing as cultural difference. I don't mean that we should abandon using the term culture. But the kind of the really kind of the profound similarity that kind of cuts across experiences across different cultures, I think, requires us to think much more critically about what we mean when we use this very commonly employed term culture, cultural difference, and cultural group. And to return to my starting point, which is the multicultural project, which, as I say, I support. I'm worried about the way in which people are retreating from it in contemporary Europe. I'm worried about the way in which people are retreating to what seems to me an imposition of a much kind of narrower kind of, you know, monolithic national identity. I'm worried about that. But I think it's one of the ironies of the multicultural project that in the name of equality and mutual respect between peoples, it's encouraged us to view peoples and cultures as more systematically different from one another than they really are. And I think the irony of that is that in the process, multiculturalism, with all the best intentions, has actually contributed to a kind of cultural stereotyping and an exaggeration of cultural difference that I think is now helping whip up the opposition to multiculturalism and is now part of what fuels the current retreat from multiculturalism. So I hope I've kind of managed to carve out a position which is saying, yes, culture does matter. Yes, there are cultural differences, but we really have to, you know, ensure that when we talk about culture, we're not talking about culture in this kind of reified, essentialized, capital letters way. And that's really the kind of the argument that I want to make. So.
Como sempre, facemos agora un pequeno descanso para tomar un café, 15 minutos, e volvemos para o debate. Moitas gracias.